Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Barry Strauss, a Bryce and Edith M. Baumer professor in humanistic studies at Cornell University, and author of many best-selling books, most recently 10 Caesars, Roman Emperors from Augustus to Constantine. This is episode CXLV, Battle of the Teutoburg Forest. In 9 CE, three Roman legions were walking through Germany when they were ambushed in what would become one of the most notorious defeats throughout Rome's history. The loss of the legions were a crippling blow to Rome's plans of expansion and redrew the borders in the province. Here's Barry Strauss.
The Battle of Teutoburg Forest is a completely fascinating engagement from the point of view of military history and practice, and has lessons for us in modern warfare today. But also from the point of history, it's remarkable. It was a true turning point in the history of Germany, Rome, Europe, and the world. If the Romans hadn't suffered their crushing defeat at the Teutoburg Forest, they would have been able to continue the policy that was well underway of turning Germany into a province, that is, Germany between the Rhine and the Elbe rivers. Instead, because of this huge defeat, they had to give up on that policy. They didn't do so overnight. They made an effort, though not a very well-funded effort, not a very serious effort to retake Germany. Within a few years, they gave up. And ever afterwards, northern Germany, east of the Rhine, remained independent and out of Roman control. And that had huge consequences for history down to the present day. Teutoburg Forest was also a slap in the face to the Emperor Augustus, because it had been his policy to conquer Germany. He had been the force behind this effort that had been going on for decades, and now it all came tumbling down, a true stain on his record towards the end of his life. And finally, it's quite a remarkable story about the leader of the German effort at the Teutoburg Forest, Arminius, the German tribal leader who was also a Roman citizen and an equestrian at that. He was the man who had carried this operation out and done so quite brilliantly. So all around quite interesting. And by the way, also one other point, it is now a fascinating story in archaeology and history because of the discovery of the site of the battle in recent decades.
So when we're talking about this as a historical event, what sources are we working with? What historians are writing about it from the Roman context?
Well, as so often in Roman history, we don't have the world's greatest sources. It gets a brief mention in Tacitus, who is, of course, an excellent historian. More or less a contemporary is Velleius Paterculus, who is writing under the reign of Augustus's successor, Tiberius. And then in the reign of Hadrian, so quite a bit later, we have Florus, who gives a brief description of it. The longest and most detailed description is in Cassius Dio, who is a Roman senator from the Greek East, writing in the reign of Septimius Severus and his sons. So we're in the early 3rd century of our era, so far removed from the event, about 200 years later. And Cassius Dio, not a great military historian, so that also leaves something to be desired. The fact that we now have archaeological evidence from the site is quite helpful, though in some cases it leaves a lot of questions open. We also have archaeological evidence from some other sites in Germany. For example, there is a place called Waldgiermes near Frankfurt, which has been shown to be have been a Roman town. The Romans set up this place with a forum and temples, and clearly they were planning a civilian settlement of Germany, just similar to those in other provinces that they had conquered. So that is quite valuable and gives us some sense of the investment the Romans were making in this region.
So when you look at it as a Roman battle and a Roman defeat, how significant was it for Rome? Because this is one of the great defeats of the empire, isn't it? There's a few Punic War ones, I think, that you could put up there as well, but this is quite a standout event.
It is really the fact that the Romans lose three legions as well as some auxiliaries. That's a huge loss. That's something like 10% of their legionary manpower, which is no small thing in any one battle. But it's also an enormous shock to Roman prestige that the Germans, who are quote-unquote barbarians, should be able to inflict such a defeat on the mightiest empire in the world. Augustus, the emperor, actually had German bodyguards in Rome who he immediately dismisses because he's frightened. But also, no doubt, as a publicity move, he wants to dismiss them. He is trying to show that Rome still stands strong, and this one defeat is not enough to shake the empire. Tremendous difficulty also for him and his family, because he is the first emperor, and there's absolutely no guarantee that his dynasty is going to continue after his death. His success was predicated in large part on victory, on a series of military victories. And suddenly he was a loser. This was a defeat, and a big defeat. So this is all a big problem for Augustus and for the Romans.
So can you give me some specifics about what exactly the Romans lost in this battle? You said three legions. So yes. These were the 17th, 18th, and 19th legions. Yes. And associated cavalry.
Well, the legions would be, on paper at any rate, 15,000 men. And then, you know, it's difficult to say, but not out of the question that there were several thousand more who were lost. Cavalry, as well as various camp followers, hangers-on, suppliers, etc., and so forth. So it's a big loss of human life. Some of them were taken prisoner, by the way.
Yeah.
So not all of them slaughtered.
And Rome had been fighting in the area for quite a while. And what was this group specifically doing at the time?
Well, they were on a, what might call, a victory tour. The Romans believed that they had pacified Germany. There were some signs that they hadn't done so, but they tended to ignore those. And they were just traveling through areas that they'd already considered pacified, just showing the flag, as it were. And having gone as far as they're going to go that summer, they were headed back towards their base on the west side of the Rhine.
Mm.
The particular route that they take on this march was not one that they were familiar with. And Arminius had cleverly routed them away from the area that they knew, all the better to carry out an ambush. But they certainly had marched through Germany before.
So tell me about Publius Varus, the man who was leading the Roman troops. What do we know about him?
Well, he was a senator and a governor, and he had been the governor of Syria. He was very well connected. He was married to Vipsania, who was a daughter of Agrippa, who was Augustus's right-hand man, or had been Augustus's right-hand man. Agrippa was no longer with us in AD 9. You know, Augustus and the sources try to blame this whole mess on Varus, but he'd been a fairly successful governor of Syria, and he was experienced. He is taken in by Arminius, there's no question about that, but I don't think we can write him off as a complete incompetent or fool or someone who knew nothing about the military. Not true at all.
And you mentioned Arminius a few times. He was a guide, but he was with the Romans.
So Arminius was a German. There are probably about 50 different Germanic tribes in this period. And he his tribe was the Cherusci. And he was an ally of the Romans. He had fought in the auxiliaries for the Romans. He'd been made a Roman citizen. And not that many people were made Roman citizens in this period of history. And actually been admitted to the equestrian order, which means he was in the second wealthiest group in Roman society, so a very elite group. He had gone very, very far and high for a foreigner in Roman service, which made him all the more valuable as a double agent, which in effect he was, because he is leading the Romans into this disaster. He also knows how the Romans fight. He knows how to talk to a Roman. He knows how to think like a Roman. Again, immensely valuable.
And was he close to Varus? Do we know how trusted he was?
Yes, they shared meals together. Varus trusted him entirely. And even though Varus received warnings not to trust Arminius, Varus dismissed those warnings and continued to trust Arminius, which was, of course, a fatal mistake.
We're quite familiar with the standard gear that a Roman would fight with, but what would the Germans be attacking with?
They would be attacking with javelins and also swords. I mean, remember, some of them had actually fought for the Romans or with the Romans, so they would have some Roman weapons. They probably wouldn't have anything like the armor that the Romans would have, and they would not be as orderly and uniform as a Roman legion. But they had the advantage of surprise, and they had the advantage of terrain as well, because they weren't boxed into this narrow pass.
And how many Germans do we think there was over the course of this?
I've seen estimates of 18,000, but I think those are very rough estimates. We don't really know.
How did the battle itself start then? And is it fair to call it a battle? I think that might be a good way to start.
Well, that's a good question. Is it fair to call it a battle? It's a kind of a battle. It's an exercise, I think, in unconventional warfare. I think it's an ambush. And so to begin at the beginning, the trap has to be set and then sprung. And the Romans are led into the trap by Arminius. He wants to lead Varus on this particular path, and he and his associates have set up this ambush so that the Roman army is going to have to pass through a pass that goes between a hillside, so at the foot of a hill to the south, and a bog to the north. And so they have to persuade the Romans to do this. They also have to be prepared for the Romans. So Arminius is traveling with Varus, and then at a certain point, he leaves Varus. He says he's going to go ahead to make arrangements. But of course, the arrangements that he is making is the preparations for the ambush. A Roman army would not travel without having cavalry scouts going in advance to make sure things are safe. The cavalry, though, were rarely Roman citizens, and I suspect that these were German cavalrymen who were probably in on the ambush. Just to be clear, it's not that the Germans are doing this because they're bad or mean or anything. They have genuine grievances against the Romans, who have been pushing them around for a long time. I mean, why are the Romans invading Germanic territory in the first place? They don't have any real reason to do so. It's greed and glory and paranoia, all of the usual things. And they are throwing their weight around, as imperial powers often do, and mistreating ordinary Germans. And the Germans still have a spirit of freedom. They don't want to be mistreated by the Romans, although there are some Germans who collaborate with the Romans, who become Roman citizens, even some who do, like Arminius, have mixed feelings about it and ultimately decide that it's not viable and that they'd rather fight against the Romans. Mm. So it wouldn't be surprising if they're Germanic cavalry who actually are in cahoots with Arminius and don't report back to Varus that there's an ambush ahead. Now, as you know, we talk about Teutoburg Forest from the Latin Teutoburgiensis saltus, but saltus, which could be translated as a forest or a grove, can also be translated as a pass, as in a mountain pass. And there's some who propose that we should actually think of this as the Teutoburg Pass, rather than the Teutoburg Forest. The site is not an especially dramatic mountain pass if you compare it to mountain passes in the Alps or any other mountain range, but nonetheless, it clearly is a road that passes, as I said, between the foot of a hill and what in antiquity would have been a substantial bog or marsh, and that's where the Roman army has to travel.
So it narrows them in and
it narrows them in. Yes, it's well chosen as a place to carry out an ambush.
But where are the Germans ambushing from?
It's a wooded hill. It's not a bare hill. Oh, and there are trees on the edge of the marsh as well. So they are in the woods on this hillside, and some of them are in the trees on the edge of the marsh. And they attack the Romans as the Romans come in.
And despite what we would think of as a sudden ambush, this is a slow process is the wrong word. This is a drawn out event, isn't it?
It's a drawn out event. Yes. Yeah, we want it to take place in a Hollywood hour and 50 minutes or something.
Oh no, look, you know, this would be a tight 30, you know. This would be the one event, but it's like Dyer refers to a fourth day, I think, in his text. So yes. This is a real kind of
it goes on for several days. You know, the excavators found evidence of a turf wall there, and at first they thought the wall was built by the Germans to hide behind. But when I was there last summer, they said they changed their mind, and they now think that this was built by the legionaries for shelter, to try to protect themselves.
Right, so they had time to build a wall.
Yes, somebody did, and it might have been the Romans.
Yeah.
On the one hand, when the Germans first attack and they have surprise as a force multiplier to help them, the legionaries are packed too tightly together in this narrow space to be able to form a good defensive order. And the original attack must have been quite a shock and very effective, with the Germans throwing javelins against the Romans. This goes on for several days, and clearly the Romans are able to form some kind of defensive order. The Germans no doubt got reinforcements who come. So in the beginning, you can imagine Arminius rallying people from various tribes, various peoples, and there'd be some who'd join it eagerly and others who'd be quite skeptical and who would say, are you kidding? We can't defeat the Romans. But once the news gets out that they've actually had an initial success, then others are going to come and join them. Mm-hmm. And the Germanic forces are going to grow.
So since the Romans are essentially a moving target, and I imagine quite a long drawn out wagon train of three legions.
Yes.
Is this a long battlefield? Is this one that stretches on? Because they would have been walking for four days still.
And you know, the excavations, which are ongoing, this is stretched over several kilometers.
Mm.
The actual pass itself is not that long an area, but the legions, they weren't all in it at once.
So if Dio is the most, I'm not sure if I call it the best account, the most thorough account that we've got.
Yes, it's the most detailed account.
The most detailed account. What does he tell us about how this battle unfolded?
He talks about how important deception was in setting this up. And he talks about a conspiracy on the part of Arminius and Segimerus, who were both close to Varus. He talks about the weather was miserable, troubling for the Romans and helpful for the Germans, because they were more used to the bad weather there than the Romans were. Now, Dio tells us that the Romans had many wagons and beasts of burden with them, and there were not a few women and children and a large retinue of servants who were following them. He says that in the beginning, at first, the Germans hurled their volleys from a distance, and then as no one defended himself and many were wounded, they approached closer to them. He claims the Romans were not proceeding in any regular order, but were mixed in helter-skelter with the wagons and the unarmed, and so being unable to form readily anywhere in a body and being fewer at every point than their assailants, they suffered greatly and could offer no resistance at all. There is another attack on the fourth day. He says the Romans were still advancing when the fourth day dawned. Again, a heavy downpour and a violent wind assailed them, preventing them from going forward and even from standing securely, and moreover, depriving them of the use of their weapons. They could not handle their bows or their javelins with any success, nor for that matter their shields, which were thoroughly soaked. Their opponents, on the other hand, being for the most part lightly equipped and able to approach and retire freely, suffered less from the storm. Furthermore, the enemy's forces had greatly increased, as many of those who had first wavered joined them, largely in the hope of plunder. Thus they could more easily encircle and strike down the Romans, whose ranks were now thinned, many having perished in the earlier fighting. So Dio doesn't know it, but he is offering us a classic account of unconventional warfare and of the advantage of light-armed locals against the more heavily armed and more orderly and disciplined outsiders. When he says that the motive of the Germans was largely plunder, that seems to me a slander. The Germans' motives could as easily have been revenge or a desire for freedom, some more noble motives than simply wanting plunder.
Mm. I do have to say that's quite detailed for a dire battle scene. It does come across very much, as you said earlier, as confidence is building for the Germans as this attack goes on, and just how chaotic it is for the Romans to try and form up and defend themselves.
Well, if they did build a turf wall, then there was a little bit of an attempt at a defense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you make a good point, but knowing the discipline of the Roman legions and the professionalism of the centurions, I find it hard to believe the Romans just lay down and died. I'm sure they did try to fight back to the extent that they could, but they're in a very bad situation.
Did Dyer say anything about what Varus was doing during the fight or the leadership that he was providing?
I think they kind of trash Varus, but they do credit him for committing suicide following the example of his father and his grandfather.
Varus's father, Sextus Quintilius Varus.
Does he commit suicide after Philippi?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Because I remember reading that it was such a strange thing that Varus was a good friend of Augustus, but his father was essentially on the other side.
You know, it's strange and not so strange. The period of the civil wars, and especially the triumviral period, was basically the heyday of treachery.
Mm.
And people constantly changing sides. It happened all the time. Even some of the people who fought for Antony and Cleopatra at the Battle of Actium are later on welcomed into Augustus's camp. So it happens all the time in that period.
Really? Did he do that?
Absolutely.
Considering what Brutus did, I'm surprised that he didn't learn from that kind of example.
Sosius, who's commanding the left wing at Actium for Antony, later on becomes a pillar of Augustan Rome.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I guess in that case, it worked out well.
It did.
So Varus commits suicide. So we do have reference to that happening.
Yes. Very few survive. Most of them are killed. Some of them are enslaved. A few make it back to the Roman base, which I think is at Xanten. It was called Vetera, veterans camp in northern Germany. Another marvelous archaeological site, by the way, but that's another story. A few make it back and bring news of the disaster. And some of them are only released from slavery years later. But Augustus, of course, is horrified, goes into mourning, and makes the famous cry, Quintilius Varus, give me back my legions. In other words, blaming it on Varus, not taking the credit himself for this whole German campaign, which is really just a terrible idea from the word go.
Mm.
And if it wasn't a terrible idea, the Romans did not pay enough attention to security, did not pay enough attention to the fact that the Germans could fight back. They considered the area pacified when there were plenty of indications that it hadn't been pacified. But they decide, being Romans, they're not going to accept the defeat. So they send armies back into Germany to fight against the Germans, to try to get revenge and kill Arminius and to retake their colony there. Their settlements are abandoned. They're abandoned in haste right around this time. So it clearly seems to be a response to the defeat in Teutoburg Woods.
The head of Varus does make it back to Rome, doesn't it?
Yes. Arminius finds Varus's corpse and he cuts off his head. Arminius sends the head to an important Germanic king, King Maroboduus, as inducement to join an alliance against Rome. But the king is not convinced that this alliance is going to succeed. And so he declines the offer of an alliance and he sends the head to Rome, where it is buried. So Varus, in a sad and ironic manner of speaking, does finally make it back to Rome.
And that was Arminius's attempt to form a new coalition of sorts and capitalize on this, doesn't it?
Yes. Bodus is king of the Marcomanni, a very important Germanic people, and that would have been a real feather in Arminius's cap if he could have had this alliance. But it's a sign that Roman power is hardly to be ignored and has hardly been defeated that Maroboduus declines the offer.
So we've got one kind of scene after the credits of this movie of the Battle of Teutoburg Forest, if you want to call it that,
where
Germanicus goes to the scene and is told about it by survivors. And if I remember correctly, this is how Tacitus relates the event through the eyes of Germanicus.
Yes. Germanicus sees the bones, the unburied bones of Roman soldiers, and he buries them. He gets just a sign of what a disaster this had been. I don't think Tacitus mentions it, but he might have also seen little makeshift shrines that the Germans put up after the battle to commemorate their victory. And Germanicus's mission, of course, is to get revenge and to reestablish the Roman colony of Germany and to recover standards that the Romans have lost. This is a great shame for legions to have lost their standards, and very important in Roman public life and public relations for the leaders to be able to say that they have recovered lost standards.
So how significant was this as an event? You said that it was one of the great defeats of Rome at the start of this, but this really enforced the limitations of the empire at the time, didn't it?
Yes. I mean, Germanicus wants to reconquer Germany. He has the name Germanicus not because of his achievements, but because of his father's. His father had been given the name Germanicus because of his campaigns in Germany, and the young man inherited the name from his father. He wants to continue it, but the plug is pulled on him by the Emperor Tiberius, his uncle. Probably for two motives. The less creditable motive is that Tiberius does not want his nephew to get the glory of reconquering Germany, as he feels that it might threaten his own position. But the much more serious, I think important motive is that Tiberius feels that the empire has reached its limits, and that the strain of conquering and pacifying and holding Germany is not worth it. They've lost three legions, which is a very big deal, and they don't reconstitute them under Tiberius. It would have been very expensive to replace those legions. And the lesson of all these wars is that the Germans are not pacified, and that the war will go on and on and on. It will be expensive and destabilizing, because it's precisely frontier wars that caused the death of the Roman Republic in the first place. That's simplistic, I admit, but any leader like Tiberius would have to worry about the cost of this. He knew that the empire had other frontiers besides this one. And finally, he knew that Germany was not a wealthy area. What would the Romans get from conquering Germany besides prestige? They wouldn't get very much. There just wasn't that much to loot and exploit in Germany. So he pulls the plug and decides that Rome is not going to have this new province, but instead the Rhine is going to be the effective frontier of the Romans in this part of the world. So hugely significant for the history of Europe, because most of Germany remains free of Roman rule, and the Germans are free to retain their language and to develop according to their own particular customs.
Yeah, if the Romans conquered that, they might be speaking Latinized languages these days.
I think they probably would be. I think the model would be France or Romania, two areas that spoke non-Latin languages and today speak Latinized languages. It would have had huge consequences for European history.
So you've visited the site of this, you said earlier.
Yes.
What sort of sense do you get of the site?
The site is convincing. I mean, it is at the foot of a hill. The bog is no longer visible, but there's a tree line there. I have to say the site itself is not all that dramatic, especially if you live as I do in upstate New York. It actually kind of looks like upstate New York. It's hilly, but no mountains or anything, and kind of gloomy and rainy, which is what the climate's like here. But the museum is fantastic. There's really just a spectacular museum at the site. They have found some wonderful things there, you know, bits of weaponry, many coins from Augustus and his grandsons. Some of the coins are stamped with the VAR for Varus. Mm. They have found parts of legionary uniforms. They have found some human skulls, but also animals. they have found this remarkable substratum of a dress cavalry helmet. The silver coating that originally would have been there has been looted, but the iron base is still there, and it stares out ghost-like at you from the museum. And there also happened to be an exhibit about Roman legions there as well. So all in all, quite a spectacular place.
And do you get a sense that this is the place where this battle took, that this battle happened? Do you feel the presence of 15,000 Roman soldiers?
You do. But like so many ancient battle sites, you do and you don't. It certainly seems credible, but if you ask me, if you go there and say, this must be the place and nowhere else could possibly be the place, no, you don't get that sense. But I think there's a lot of scholarship going back to Mommsen in the 19th century that explain why there has been a road that passed through here since time immemorial and that was still in use in early modern times, and why it makes a whole lot of sense for this to be the site. As you know, it was discovered by accident by a British serviceman, I think in 1987, who used a metal detector and found coins there. And then immediately the archaeologists came in and professionally excavated it. So they're always skeptics, as with any ancient site, but it certainly fits the bill. And the day I was there, it was kind of gloomy and dark and drizzling. And you thought, oh yeah, I could see it happening here.
So the question I want to finish on is, what is the perception of this battle in modern day? While it was significant to the Romans and the Germans at its time, is it still significant to the Germans today?
Well, I think so. It was very significant in the 19th century upon the unification of Germany. They built a statue for the battle called the Hermann Denkmal. It was at the site that people at the time thought it was the right place for the battle, but it's about 60 miles away from the site where we now know the battle took place. I haven't seen it, but it is this sort of schlocky bronze 19th century statue. In its own way, very similar to the schlocky bronze 19th century statue of Vercingetorix that Napoleon III had erected at the site of Alesia. So Arminius in the Renaissance was dubbed Hermann. He certainly had a name in Germanic language at the time, and it might have been Hermann. We're not really sure of that. There's some people who think that actually his name was Arminius, and that it was a nickname from Armenia, that perhaps he had fought there, or we're not really sure where the name came from. So Hermann is a guess, though a reasonable guess, and he has been an important figure since the Renaissance in German historical consciousness as somebody who defended German freedom. I think he's a very important figure and a very interesting one from the point of view of military studies today, because this is just a spectacularly successful example of unconventional warfare. And in some ways, the information campaign that he carried out before the battle is as interesting as the battle itself. The fact that he was able to carry out this deception of the Romans is so crucial. You know, as so often in military history, setting up the battlefield is as important as the battle itself. I mean, I think of the Battle of Salamis, where Themistocles did such a great job of deceiving the enemy into fighting in a place that was inconvenient for the enemy. Likewise, Arminius did a great job of convincing the Romans into going to the wrong place. So they're textbook battles, and they should be studied in military academies if they aren't.
That was Barry Strauss, a Bryce and Edith M. Baumer Professor in Humanistic Studies at Cornell University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or your local friendly neighborhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They help others find the podcast. Professor Strauss is the author of many best-selling history books. I'd like to recommend a favorite of mine, The Death of Caesar. He also has his own history podcast, which I highly recommend. It's called Antiquitas. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Barry on Twitter. Barry is at Barry Strauss. I'm at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for the Emperors of Rome. Before I leave, the next episode of my other podcast, When in Rome, will be on Calcriesi, the site of the Battle of Teutoburg Forest. Until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.